Morning, a open rules hearing on 14-04, petition to create WISSTAT 80119 relating to the protection of information in circuit court records. I have as the presenter Judge Patak. And then the other appearances are Kathleen Madden, clerk, Waukesha County, Carlo Esqueda, clerk, Dane County. Are there any other appearances? If someone feels moved to speak, they can rise later. Judge?
May it please the court. Good morning. Chief Justice Abramson and Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Gerald Patak, a Circuit Court Judge in Racine County, and I'm here to speak in support of the rule before you this morning, which is designed to protect personal information in Circuit Court records. I want to make a point initially from the outset here regarding this rule, because it was filed at the same time that the rule asking for a mandatory e-filing was filed. I want to make the point that this rule is not dependent on that rule. I know that it's been taken up by this court and has been tabled based on financial decisions that relate to the budget. But this rule, the rule regarding redaction and confidential information, can go forward without the passage of the e-filing rule. So the goal of the rule is twofold. Number one is to try to protect information that identifies us as individuals, and secondly, to have the effect of stopping or thwarting efforts that might be made to steal someone's personal identity. There are features of the rule that I'd like to highlight before I talk to you about the five specific things that it does. The first is, who is required to act here? The requirement to file documents in compliance with the rule rests upon the filer. It's not the responsibility of the clerk of courts to redact documents or to keep information out of the court records based on this rule that we don't want in them. So it's, again, the public, the filer, whether they're a lawyer, a non-lawyer, et cetera, it's their responsibility to do that. Secondly, when does this become effective? The effective date is the date that you, if you presumably pass the rule, decide it's effective. And from that day forward, all documents filed would be required to comply with the rule. As I'll mention later, there is a method that goes to previously filed matters and deals with how we protect confidential information in them. But at this point, it goes forward. It is a prospective rule, not retroactive. Another thing the rule does, it's a feature of what I think as a judge, is it provides for the first time a procedure for people who are filers to use to seal documents if they want something sealed. And I'll talk about that in more detail as I go on here as well. Finally, also, there's a way to deal with previously filed documents if you want something that is to be excluded and confidentially treated, and that's it creates a motion practice to allow filers of matters that are already in our files to protect confidential information that they want out. And the final feature I'll mention briefly is it also sets up a method to deal with transcripts. So whether a transcript is filed or not, whether it's currently going to be prepared in the future, it sets up a method for that to occur. So the five parts of the rule, the very first one is the redaction of confidential numbers, referring to these in the rule as protected information. The rule requires that this information not be included in filings that are filed with the circuit court from the date of enactment of forward. Those rules or those numbers include the obvious: Social Security numbers, employer or taxpayer ID numbers, financial accounts such as bank accounts, et cetera, a driver's license number, and passport numbers.
Well, then number six says similar information deemed protected by court order. What does that mean?
The process includes a way for the court to order certain things to be confidential. So let's say, for example, a party wants a number protected, and it's not on the list. The person, the filer, files a motion with the court filing the number.
And now where does it say file?
In terms of where the rule is?
Yep. Because I sort of wanted to go through it to see what you do. Is that H?
Are you talking about the somewhat standard practice that judges use when, for example, you get an unusual situation in court, like a domestic abuse injunction extension where the victim doesn't want the person to know her new address, something like that that judges currently do, or unusual situations that come up where judges issue certain protections that are case specific?
Yes. And if there's a number that someone wants in the litigation, for example, that is a protected number by this rule, then they would file the number with the form that you see that's attached to the memo, asking that it be in the file but treated confidential. So if they need the number, for example, if the Social Security number is somehow relevant to the case, then the filer would file that with the document that asks it to be in the case but to be treated confidentially, right? And what that does is it tells the clerk that that information doesn't go in the public file. It goes into the envelope that's in the paper file, which is the confidential data that might be in a file, or it is programmed so that it's not available to the public if they look at the file via computer, if it's an electronically filed case, but only available to the parties or to the people the clerk designates to be able to have access.
So like a financial statement in a family court action. That might have your Social Security number on it, but, for example, that shouldn't just be open to the public for anyone who wants
to
have it.
By law, that is a confidential document already. And I think the practice in most places is to keep it confidential and put it in an envelope. And so if the public comes for a paper file, the clerk takes that out, hands the public person the paper file that they're allowed to look at by law, and doesn't let them look at what's in the envelope.
So what you're trying to do with this rule is basically have that kind of procedure in place so that personal information isn't open to the public.
Correct. In both the paper world and the electronic world. All right? So after the redaction of confidential numbers,
Your Honor, not
yes.
Counsel. Your venerable judge from Racine County, that's what I meant to say. It's helpful to me if you go through the procedures as set forth in the text of the proposed rule. I understand the proposed rule deals with, as you were just discussing, Social Security numbers, it deals with taxpayer ID numbers, it deals with driver's license, I think also financial account numbers, passport numbers, those kinds of things. So we have the listing of what it protects under definitions and one. In sub two, required redaction. Where are you in your presentation right now? I know the Chief Justice asked you about sub six, and so I'm...
What I was intending to do was to highlight the features of the bill and then to answer questions that might relate to the sections of the statute. But I'd be glad to answer the Chief's question if I can. She was referring to section...
I'm not so much... I'm sure she'll be happy to have your question answered. My question or request is that you, at some time during your presentation, walk us through the procedures as they fit with the subheadings in the proposal.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, so what does deemed mean? I'm sorry, I had to leave before I had a...
Sorry?
I said, what does deemed mean there?
It means that the court has authority to order things confidential if the court should decide, all right?
So similar information, you don't need deemed then, why don't you just say similar information protected by court order?
Yes.
Would that, is that,
that
what
would
you
sufficient.
Mean? Okay. Thank you. All right.
I share Justice Bradley's desire that you go through the procedure.
Okay.
Because I found this rule quite complicated.
All right.
But
I will.
I also looked at A6, similar information deemed protected by court order. It seems to me, if I were the plaintiff's attorney and I filed a pleading, that's covered by this rule.
Correct.
And so I couldn't put somebody's Social Security number in the pleading.
Correct.
But I don't quite see how, if I'm filing a complaint, that I would know that something was protected by court order.
Well, that's a matter of looking at the court file and the documents. If the court signs an order, it's distributed to the parties, so the party would be informed by the courts having ordered it. It's not a general order that's contemplated. This contemplates on a case-by-case basis that the court might deem that something needs to be confidential, even on its own motion. But the procedure here allows for a motion to be brought by a party to protect information if it's not required to be protected by the rule or by existing law.
But what I'm saying, Your Honor, if I'm the plaintiff's attorney and I file a complaint, I'm starting the litigation.
Yes.
There are no court orders.
Correct. So the issue with respect to what is to be not included is an issue of education. And we have a plan, I think, that includes how this information would be disseminated to lawyers and practitioners so that they would be aware of what the rule is and what the requirements are.
Is the court order that you're talking about specific to the case in which I'm filing the complaint, or is some
yes,
sort of
it would be. But I can't envision that the court would enter an order in a case until it's been filed, right?
Yeah.
Something may come up. I'm just trying to envision what it might be. In most cases, it's going to be the filers who are going to ask for things to be filed confidentially if they're not required to be, you know, excluded by the rule. The example I gave earlier about a Social Security number, this rule says you can't file the Social Security number you put in the four last digits. That's already the practice in the circuit courts with respect to family cases, for example. Lawyers don't include, as a matter of course, the Social Security number. They use the format we all see in our lives, which is the last four digits. So there would be, if there was a need for the Social Security number as relevant information in the file, and the rule says you can't put it in there, but you need it, then you as the filer would file the motion or the document that's attached to the memorandum with the Social Security number listed in full, which is filed in a confidential manner. It's under seal. It's not available. So the filer would get the Social Security number into the record for the parties and the judge in the case to be able to get access to, whether that's in the paper world or the electronic world. But John Q. Public, looking at the file, would not be able to see or get to the Social Security number. All right?
If you look at provision 2F,
yes,
it says that the confidentiality is, as to the person's own information, is waived by filing it without the information in a protected form. And I have concerns about pro se filers who probably won't know about all of this. We can educate the bar. Can they really waive something?
There would be information given to them in terms of how they file documents, including, for example, in part of the rule, there are certain documents that are already required by law to be confidential. The clerk of courts would have a list of those things available to hand to filers so that they would know what has to be filed in a confidential way by law.
So if a pro se filer files, say, a petition in a divorce action and includes information that is confidential, is it the clerk's obligation to turn away the petition then, or what happens?
No. Okay. The clerk is not the gatekeeper, not required to look at documents to see what's there that shouldn't be there. No. It is the filer's responsibility, whether they're represented or pro se.
Okay, so if a wife files it and puts her husband's Social Security number in it, in the document, and her own, certainly she can waive confidentially as to her own, but it seems there's no protection initially given to the husband's either, correct?
And under those circumstances, there wouldn't be, other than he or counsel for him could ask it to be redacted.
Well, if we have a lawyer involved, I don't have the concerns that I do have here and there. I'm just concerned about how does it work with pro se filers, and I know in family matters we have quite a lot of them.
Yes, so. We do. More and more.
Well, I'm not so sure. I didn't read F that way. First, it says a party waives the protection of this section as to the person's own information by filing it without the protected information form. Now, a party may be different than a person. A party may be the corporation. A person might be involved in the litigation.
Yes.
And there might be financial account number involved for that person or something else. So I found that a little confusing. A party waives the protection as to the person, but they're not the same people. And if a party fails to comply, the court may seal the improperly filed documents and order new documents to be prepared. So although the clerk isn't responsible, the court may be,
yes,
if I understand that second sentence.
Yes.
And then the third sentence I have a bigger question mark about. That says, if a party, we're back to party, fails to comply with the requirements of this rule in regard to another individual's. So person could be a corporation, party can be a corporation, individual is not generally considered,
right,
a corporation or a partnership. If a party fails to comply in regard to another individual's protected information, the court may impose reasonable expenses, including attorney fees and costs, or sanction the conduct as contempt. There's an awful lot going on in that.
Yes.
Four sentences, and they involve different people, whether they're parties or individuals or persons, and the court has obligation on motion or in its own initiative. And the last sentence seems to impose attorney fees, costs, and sanction the conduct as contempt if a party fails to comply with the rule in regard to another individual.
And
so maybe you could explain all that.
Well, we're looking for some way for a court to be able to enforce the rule, obviously, by giving court authority by relying on those things which are listed there. I think if I recall our discussions here in F, the word party is used in the first sentence, and I think that persons could be parties, which would make more sense there. That makes it clear as to who's required to, whose information it is, all right? In the second sentence, it gives the court authority, either on its own motion or someone's motion, to take something out that may have been put in, as you've mentioned, and I think that's the intent there, and that new documents be prepared so that the confidential information isn't in the public record. We put a, probably would be a redacted document, taking out the number and putting the originally filed document with the number in it in the confidential part of the file.
What does it mean if a party fails to comply with the requirements of this rule in regard to another individual's?
It means if a party files the other party's Social Security number, then the court can use its authority if it's done intentionally. Obviously, like everything else, it all depends, right? We would ask why they did it, how it happened. I didn't know of the rule. I made a mistake. Or, you know, it's a vicious person who may be vindictive and have done it on purpose. I mean, you can think of all sorts of variations that might occur.
We've had a request that you go through the process, so let's see if we can do that. We've interrupted you.
Okay. I'll just finish then in terms of what the highlights of the rule are before I go through the statute itself. But we've talked about the redaction of protected information. The rule also requires that when you file something, and if the law requires that it be confidential, that it be filed as such. And the director's office, the court support staff, has prepared and will provide to the clerk of courts a list of what is required in law to be confidential that will be available to the filers in the clerk of court's office to tell them what they must file and file with a confidential document on it. And again, that's that document that's attached to the memo that's attached to the rule. So the filer would file the financial disclosure statement, but they would attach that form telling the clerk it's a confidential document, put it in the confidential part of the case.
Judge, is that list prepared?
It is. It's on the court's website, on CourtNet, I believe.
Presently?
Yes. I think it's probably subject to further, you know, searching and making sure everything is there, but the staff has prepared the list, and it is on the court's website. Marcia Vanderfick can tell us what it's titled as there.
Maybe we can get the address, if you will. And is that the Director of State Courts giving legal information?
If you were to say what the overriding or overarching purpose of this rule would be, do you think it's because judges already do many of these things, but they may do them in varying ways and varying cases, and there is no common way of dealing with this issue, although it comes up on a daily basis in court?
Yes.
So you're trying to highlight the issue and create a reasonable process so people know what to do? Okay, I just wondered if that might be
right.
Your
and
ultimate
nothing
goal.
Makes that point more than my next point, which is the rule also creates a procedure by which someone can ask the court to file or to seal something in the court record, right? There's no procedure as such. Now, there is a body of case law that exists that talks about that and what standards to apply and what tests to apply. Obviously, it's based on public records and those sorts of things. But this isn't substantive law, but simply procedural law that allows for a method for a filer to make a motion to seal something that they feel is confidential. The way that would work would be that if I had a document, I wanted to file a trade secret, for example, and I wanted to file it in the court file, I wanted it filed confidential, I would file a motion with the court asking that this document, this information be confidential. It would then be heard by the court, and then once the court rules whether it's confidential or not, it would then either remain or not be confidential. And once it's filed initially, it would be treated confidential in the file until such time as the motion is decided, right? And that's a procedure that hasn't existed in law until now. And then the last point I'll make, not the last point, but another point I'll make is about how we would handle the old files that are already in the system. Since we're looking at the date of enactment and going forward to apply this rule, how would someone who's got information in the file from the past who wants something out, how would they handle that? Well, they would file a motion with the court asking for the information to be redacted. And that would be, again, identifying for the court and the clerk where that is in the record, what it is they want redacted, notice to other parties, depending on the information, perhaps public notice, since we're dealing with public records here, making sure that everyone who wants to be heard has the right to be heard, and then a court deciding whether it should be redacted or not. What happens is if the court decides to redact it, then the clerk creates a copy of the redacted document, takes out the one in the court file that exists that is containing the information, puts it in the confidential record, and then the redacted version goes into the court record itself. Let me digress here a moment, too, about what's happening in the real world. And I know I did listen to the conversation you had on the rule regarding mandatory e-filing. In the real world, in our counties, where I'm working, for example, clerks of court are archiving. They're archiving old files. They're doing it by scanning files into a computer, digital records. And for example, where I am, I was last in a civil assignment. All the files through 2013 have been scanned. Your rule that you passed that the clerk supply say that if something's been scanned, they have the right to destroy it, and it's destroyed within a certain amount of time. So paper files in a lot of counties, even old files, don't exist. They're scanned files. So, you know, we're talking a different world altogether where archiving includes scanned files. So this rule, I think, has application even more so with respect to the real world we live in, which, as we all know, every day becomes more and more dependent and connected to the electronic world and electronic records.
With the scanned file, if someone wants to see a file that's been archived by scanning, they get a microfiche? Is that what they do?
No. They go to the courthouse. Each clerk of court's office in the state has what are called public access terminals. So it's an office where people go, sit down at a computer, pull up the record, and they can look at the record.
So it's just electronically that they can see it. They don't have to have any object except the computer.
That's right. No password. They don't have to be a party because what they're looking at is what's publicly accessible. If it's an electronic record and they're a party, then they would have access to the entire case, all right? Whereas the public only gets what's in the public record, okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So what do you do or hereafter should this rule pass and there's redaction of particular numbers? What appears on the scanned copies?
Well, in the scanned document, if it's been redacted, you would get a blackened space and then, like, the last four numbers, all right?
And I'm assuming from this rule, but I could be wrong, that there'll be times where there'll be two documents on file. One, a redacted document.
Right.
And two, the complete original document with protected information, right?
Correct.
So if we were going to scan that in next year,
sure.
What happens? Are both scanned? Is only the redacted scanned? Or both scanned, but that the unredacted is not open to public view?
The unredacted is not public available to public view. Correct. It's
but
for
it's
party's eyes only.
But it's held, but there is a copy of it.
Correct.
In existence so that a whole
Absolutely.
File is complete.
A whole file is scanned. Whether it's the public access part of it or the parties only part of it, the whole file is scanned. So then in addition to redacting and going back to old files and how that will be handled, the other part that's a highlight of the rule is how to handle transcripts. And what the rule does is it gives, after a transcript has been prepared, after the effective date of the rule, obviously, then the parties have 30 days to file a motion with the court to ask that any information that's in the transcript be redacted. If it's identified, then and the parties agree and the court orders it, the court reporter does what you might expect. Takes that page, and that page only, not the entire transcript, and creates a redacted page, eliminating the information in compliance with the court order. Then that redacted page goes in the transcript, which is in the public record, and the unredacted page goes into the confidential portion of the case file. So the person gets the redaction. Again, the Social Security number is a good example. Someone's on the witness stand. They're asked, what's your Social Security number? And they give it all, and it's in the record. How do they get it out? Okay. So then if I digress from there, those are the highlights of the rule. And if I go to the rule itself and the statute and the petition, in the text of the proposed rule, we've talked about sub 1 sub A, the definitions section. Sub 2 is the section that talks about the requirement for redaction and protected information, and it creates the requirement that certain information be redacted and protected, and it talks about how you would go about getting information protected if it's not required to be redacted. One of the things that we've changed here That's later on in sub 4. But the section lists all the requirements for omitting protected information, basically. I wonder if you have any questions about
sub 2. With protected information, but it also deals with documents.
Yes.
Right? Because the documents have the protected information.
Right.
And so when I was going through reading this, I wanted to make sure that the right word, rather, is whether it's protection, whether it's information, protected information, or document, is used, and I'm not sure that it is. I didn't catch any, but that's what I was looking for.
Okay.
The other thing is, I was interested is protected information doesn't appear on a pleading or other document. And then it's when submitting a pleading or other original document, that's under C1, so it's the word original is added there. And sub 2, when submitting an exhibit or other previously existing document. So we got pleading, document, original document, exhibit, previously existing document.
I think we're trying to cover all the bases there to catch all the things that might be in a court record, because I think this applies to, you know, not just those cases which are filed prospectively, but also going backward in time and trying to find a way to cover previously filed actions as well.
My problem was by changing these words in each of these sections or subsection, you may be limiting what is intended rather than intend broadly, but I...
Well, if there's an issue that you have you want us to look at again, we'd be glad to, you know, look at the wording and resubmit it or, you know, accept whatever your advice is there.
You understand what I'm driving
at? Yes,
I
do. Yeah.
And I'm not sure that there's anything the matter. It's just I'm not sure that there isn't anything the matter.
Okay.
So I'm in a
position
where I'm not clear.
I think it's been pointed out that with regard to F under sub 2, there's a need for a little... wordsmithing there with regard to persons in the first sentence, and also I think with regard to the word individuals in the last sentence.
Making sure that individuals isn't people, but broader, you mean?
Well, what I have in mind with regard to individual, let's say it's, as Justice Rokensack indicated, a divorce case. And husband owns a car dealership, and it's a corporation, right? And he's not, there's a little question about how honest he's being. And so the business information is listed among the documents.
So you're suggesting something broader, more encompassing?
Yeah, I think perhaps you could just do in regard to another's protected information. That might be one way to do it, but you can, you know,
yes.
Decide.
Okay.
Individuals. The
yes, I understand. All right. So moving on to sub 3, when documents may be filed as confidential, talks about the list that the director's office would maintain and compile about what's required to be filed as confidential under law, as law now exists, statute or case law. And it makes the responsibility of that of the filing party to identify the document at the time of filing, and it notes that the court's not required to review documents to determine if the documents are confidential in nature. Again, it's not the court's responsibility, the clerk's responsibility. It is the filer's responsibility.
How many times in here do you make it the court's responsibility, do you think? And I'm talking about in here being the entire petition.
I think it's generally where the court has the authority on its own motion to order something to be confidential that the parties may not see or be aware of. And the court sees the need. Sub 4 talks about submitting documents under seal, the procedure there. Again, basically, if a trade secret is filed, the party files a motion asking that it be confidential. Once it's filed, it remains confidential until the motion is decided. Once it's decided, it either remains open to the public or is confidential based upon decision. I guess I'd say, you know, we're talking about this beforehand, you know, this is a rule. We have to cover all eventualities. My guess is, from my experience as a judge and a lawyer, that most of these aren't going to be disputed. I mean, my experience in the civil law, for example, is that lawyers generally agree. You know, they want to exchange financial records of corporations. If there's some litigation ongoing, they're going to agree by stipulation that those documents should be treated as trade secrets and be confidential, not open to the public scrutiny. And you've heard the phrase in litigation, for lawyers' eyes only. That's very common. What lawyers agree to in terms of things like this that get submitted in cases that aren't the things that are required to be confidential by the rule or by case law, things that they want to add and make confidential by their procedure. So that's, there is one change at the bottom of Section C. I think that there was a memo I saw about that. We discussed this in the committee's work, and we've decided that if we leave the current ruling, it might disclose things that weren't meant to be disclosed. So we're changing the wording there to allow that the record include the fact that there was an order entered ordering confidentiality and the name of the court official who ordered the confidentiality. Rather than filing the order, the motion itself or the order itself, recognizing that those documents might contain the concerned confidential information.
We got an update in preparation for this hearing, and that's in our tab 6, item 3, and that last sentence would read, if I understand it, if the court seals or redacts information, the public record shall indicate that an order to seal or redact was issued and the name of the court official entering the order.
Yes. That's it. Yes.
Thank you.
I don't know if you have any further questions about submitting documents under seal, sub 4.
I have a question about submitting documents under a seal. And we have had, as you know, the John Doe cases before us, and they have been a paper ton. That's an exaggeration, but several inches, maybe a couple of feet or more, of redacted documents. They're essentially briefs, but there are other things. And people just submitted things over a long period of time and just said, I want this under seal. And the clerk of court just put it under seal. The court never got to that.
Well, you know, the John Doe is a different animal. I'll just say that because 968 and its provisions allow the court to order it to be confidential. So how a trial court might carry that out, I think, is going to depend.
This is an appellate court.
Okay, all right.
And we have the briefs. And people filed things here under seal, and they were just, the clerk just filed them under seal, awaiting a court order, which didn't come for a long time. So I note here that the information may be filed under a temporary seal.
Right.
That's a direction to the clerk of court.
Yes.
So we got a temporary seal.
Right, until the motion is decided
right.
by the court.
But there's no timing for deciding that motion. And it can, you can have something in court for weeks, months, and maybe years without anybody making an order to seal, and the party itself has made the decision to seal. And
I think that's a good point. We'd be open to any suggestion about some time period, if you wanted to add something specific, within a certain number of days, decide the motion so it's not lingering. I think that's a good point.
I know that, you know, time flees, and what looks like reasonable on paper, like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you know, oh, well, it's Christmas and New Year's and you know, an earthquake or a snowstorm, and the 3 weeks are gone, and then we get into a fight about the timing. So I'm sensitive to that, but I'm also sensitive to the fact that unless somebody pushes, you've got a lot of documents under seal, and nobody even knows they're filed. And there's no, what is there here that says that the request that it be sealed be public? I mean, why can't John Smith suing Mary Smith? And he wants everything under seal, at least his request that it be under seal, so everybody knows there's a pending action. Everybody knows, et cetera.
I guess I would say in the real world, in terms of motions being filed, a motion, in my opinion, shouldn't be allowed to be filed without a date certain for a hearing. So it's controlled by the way we process cases.
But
I think that, you know, a time period suggesting that a decision should be made within a certain amount of time would be helpful.
Mine is that the court has to, the parties are not in charge of what's in
store. Correct.
It's the court.
Correct.
And this allows to seal a document or a whole document, or specific information in a document. And we file the motion for sealing, but neither part, sometimes both parties don't want this open, right?
Yes.
And so they could be doing whatever their thing is, and then you got this all this sealed stuff at court, and no one knows. Now, I want to know whether if there's pleading and it's and there's a motion to seal the pleading that is beginning of this lawsuit, does that get on CCAP?
It would be, if it's a motion that's filed, the motion gets into CCAP, yes.
The motion to seal gets into
right.
CCAP.
Right, exactly.
But will it show John Smith versus Mary Smith?
Well, again, you're talking about the John Doe procedure.
No, I'm talking about these guys not only can't agree on children, they can't agree on the business, they can't agree on anything, and they're suing each other.
And certainly the
not
court.
Not John Doe.
I can't envision that a trial court would allow that to occur.
No, but the trial court's not going to know. That's my problem.
Well, someone knows because they came to the courthouse and it went through the queue.
Right.
So.
It seems to me there should be a time that the court rules on whether it's sealed or not. Otherwise, you've got stacks of sealed documents that no one knows about, not even the request to seal.
I think that's a helpful suggestion and a good safeguard.
Okay. The other thing is the hearing on the motion to seal a court record open or closed?
Good question. I think it would be closed if, in fact, they're going to be discussing the information, unless it was possible to discuss it without putting the information that they want to have confidential, in the record. You wouldn't have to mention the Social Security number. You could say
or a financial record.
Right, right.
You don't have to put the numbers.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I think that has to be handled in some manner, because otherwise the trial court doesn't know whether it's open or closed hearing. And you know that the general rule is open.
Open, absolutely.
And you have to have a reason for closing. And I don't see that this deals with open or closed hearings.
We can address that.
Okay.
The rule really deals with a limited type of information, though. It's not just anything that someone may bring to the court.
Right.
And want sealed that actually comes under the rule.
You know, this isn't a tool that I see being abused. I had a lawyer ask me a question at the bar meeting that we attended to present this, and they asked whether, how am I going to protect myself against a lawyer who wants everything to be secret that I can't look at and wants to file it? Well, obviously that's the motion practice idea. If they file it, it's filed with a motion, and the court has to give them a date to be heard, and they'll have an opportunity to be heard. You know, to say this is not proper, this is an attempt to, you know, evade discovery, et cetera, whatever it might be.
Yeah, but those are possibilities because
they
are sealing.
Certainly, and I think any process is open to abuse.
You know, talking about and maybe we should let you continue. You're at four?
I was done with four. After I gave you the note about the correction on the bottom of C,
right, 4C.
Moving on to 5. This has to do...
This is redaction of previously filed documents. And
correct.
The next one is the transcript. Is that
correct.
Right?
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to go back and say there are a lot of things that maybe should be protected information, and you're, I want to congratulate you. You did a terrific job on the supporting memorandum on this, in which you indicate all of the, I shouldn't say all, many.
Right, sampling.
Many of the items that are personal identifiers in other states. And the one that caught my attention, which you probably expected, was the names of crime victims, because, as you know, we had a rule that, but that related only, appellate procedure, and only appellate briefs, because that's the stuff that's on the websites. So,
the committee did discuss all these topics. We went through the laundry list from other states, quite frankly. There are 20 states and federal agencies or governments that have rules like this. And our discussion was something like this, I guess. You know, victim rights, we have Chapter 950, a legislative enactment. Is this a policy decision that should go there and be decided there based on policy? We did discuss it. We recognize that some states did include this as an exclusion in confidential information. Another part of this is that our working committee did not include prosecutor, public defender, so the right players weren't at the table to have the discussion.
It covers criminal cases, doesn't it?
It does, yes. I guess we just didn't feel that it was an area that we felt we needed to go into or wanted to go into for those reasons and others. Also recognizing that, you know, this court has started the ball rolling. I happen to have been on that committee. I'm now the chairman of the Appellate Procedure Committee of the Council. And we recognize that, you know, this is sort of, you know, here's this whole process. It starts here and it ends here over on the appeal side. We're working on the wrong end of the process to work here. We should be starting in a criminal case with the DAs and the complaints, all right? My thought is that this rule that you've passed now is going to work its way back upstream eventually. And whether it ever becomes a statutory enactment or not, I don't know. But you set the tone by creating a procedure or a method to deal with that issue. So hopefully it'll work its way back upstream here. But we decided not to deal with that because for a lot of reasons, but those are some of them.
Juror names, names of minors, medical and psychological records.
You know, there's, again, juror names. There's case law that you've decided over the years about when jurors' names may be confidential and how the record must be built to do that. I worked on the jury committee when I was the chief judge on that committee. And there's a process for a questionnaire where a certain part of the questionnaire gives information that's available in public record, and then if you go the next step and fill out the bottom part of the questionnaire, that's confidential. So there's some of that already in law, and that procedure has been addressed, and our ways to deal with it without us putting it in this rule.
Could you speak about the last four digits?
I guess what I'd say, the last four digits seems to be common practice. I'll just tell you, in my life, you know, everywhere I go, they don't want to know my Social Security number. They want to know the last four digits, right? I get my bank statements from the bank. It's maddening to me. I wanted to know my account number. I couldn't look at the statement I got at the bank because they only include the last four digits of I had to go look elsewhere to get the account number to put it on a deposit slip. It seems to be the norm. The business practice, and that's what we followed here, the last four digits. It doesn't give anything away.
Well,
but it does help us to identify that this is, you know, you, your account, your number, et cetera.
But are you saying that the last four digits of somebody's Social Security number could appear in documents?
Yes, they would.
But you just explained the same experience that I've had. I'm always asked for the last four digits when I'm trying to get financial information on my own records. So
no one can steal your identity with the last four digits of your Social Security number. But it does help the person providing you service to identify you in their records as the person. It's a way to verify it. It's like those three numbers on your credit card, you know. Where does that come from? But it's a way to identify it without giving too much information to expose you to having someone stealing your identity.
Well, with all due respect, it seems to me if someone is attempting to steal your identity and they don't have your Social Security number, but they have a lot of other information, this would give them the last four digits.
Good. But, again, I don't know that that's information that they could do anything with.
They can call the bank and say, I'm David Prosser. And the bank says, what's your last four digits of your Social Security? And they say, 1234. And they say, well, that matches your
it's 4321.
Off the record,
first
right?
First four digits. Yeah.
Did you care to make a motion to seal that?
That's confidential, Chief. Oh.
I guess our thought was we're adopting what's common practice, the business practice. And our thought was if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us, quite frankly. If you have some other thought, we're willing to certainly work with that.
I hadn't thought of what Justice Prosser was raising previously. And I'm aware that it's common practice because it is common. But I just paused to question whether that rationale, that it's a common business practice if I were to call the bank or wherever, really translates to the objectives being sought here.
I think we could do some research in terms of finding out what the principles and the reasons are behind the business practice. Obviously, they have them. I'm not... You know, that's not my forte, but we could get further information for you about why that's done and how it is secure.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, most of this is contained in a proposed 801.19.
Correct.
Did the committee give any thought to having this fairly elaborate rule broken down into 801.19, 801.20, 801.21, something like that?
I know that this did go to the Legislative Reference Bureau, correct, for their review, so we rely on them to tell us how they want this structured. And I think they're better minds than mine to tell you how that works. You know, your staff and the court's staff and the director's office who worked on this might be able to tell you why it has to be structured this way, but that is the feedback that we've gotten from them.
Well, am I alone on the court in thinking that this rule is quite complicated? I mean, am I just obtuse? Am I a minority of one, which I often am, and just obtuse in thinking that this is a fairly complicated rule?
I object to the question. I don't think this witness can answer it. Are you alone on the court because you think?
Yes, sir. To me, it's clear as a judge as to what must be done and what the procedures are. It sets it out quite clearly in terms of how we get things out of records, how we keep things out of records so they're not filed in the first instance, and how we keep things out of record if they are filed and need to be taken out, and how we keep things out if, in fact, they are things which are in law already confidential, and so on. You know, we're talking about, again, this dichotomy of two files, really. You've got the public file where we don't want this information and the court record where judges and parties should have access to it. And that's really what this does. And I think, you know, I don't need to simplify it beyond what it really is, but I think that's the way I try to think about it in terms of just creating two separate places and how to keep, you know, this information that we don't want the people over here on the public side to have access to over here where only the parties in the court can have access.
What is the notice required by this under this section?
Notice for? It's a motion practice.
If the person seeking access cannot locate a party to provide the notice required under this section.
Okay.
What is the notice required under this section? Well,
again, if it's a motion to seal something, it has to be served. Notice has to be given. It have to be. I think that might apply to the situation where there's an old file, an existing file that's already in paper form or scanned form before the rules enactment that somebody wants to go back and exclude something from. So, for example, a party wants their Social Security number out of that record, and they try to notice other parties.
Let me just try to simplify this. Is there some place in this rule or it identifies exactly what the notice under this section is?
I don't believe that there is. Am I correct?
Well, but on the next page, it talks about the court may require that a moving party provide notice to the general public.
Yes.
If you don't have some clear indication of what the notice required under this section is, you've got to write these rules for people like me.
Right. In terms of notice requirements, again, service on parties. Public notice, I assume, would be in the normal fashion that we give public notice of things. If, in fact, that was written primarily to address the issue of the public records laws and so on, so that we would be able to give notice to people in the public who might be interested if something, you know, were to be requested to be sealed in a court file. So we don't run afoul of that.
Or after the fact, when you don't know where someone lives,
exactly,
and the only
right.
way you can provide right. notice is to give notice in the paper or notice where their last known address. I mean, the notice provisions in the statutes allow for notice in a variety of ways. But if you have someone coming back on a case from 20 years ago and you want the Social Security numbers gone and the people haven't seen each other for 20 years, the best you can do is to give the notice under the statute. So to me, that made sense because of the way things work in court. But
and in that situation, I don't know how one could claim that if they're the other party in the case, that that would somehow negatively affect them. They already have the pleadings. They have the information. We're just taking out of the file that the public has access to. Parties would still have access to the information.
You know, I'm suggesting that, and Justice Press, see if this helps you. Defining protected information to begin with is the usual form for a rule or a statute. So that seems to be in its place where the justice would look for it. I would think that the justice would then want, if he were going to submit a document under seal, to go to subsection 4. A party seeking to protect a court record, not the 3 tells you what, documents, commonly filed documents, not information, documents, right? Okay. So we now moved back to a court record, shall file a motion to seal the document or specific information in the document. That goes back to, instead, and you wouldn't want to use specific information. Wouldn't you want to use protected information, which is defined? Maybe you want it broader than that, but I don't know. That's
I think we want
problem.
It broader. It may be information that's not listed as protected information.
Okay, so protected and other information.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, then that tells you how to serve a motion. And then that the court conducts a hearing. And then the court determines whether there are sufficient grounds. Now we're back into public access. And then documents filed subsequent to the sealing order are subject to the order. So I mean, that may seem to be the first thing that if I were a lawyer trying to file something under seal, I want to know how to do it. And doesn't 4 tell you how to do it? And then, of course, it's not automatic, right?
Healing's not automatic.
No. Have
right.
And then our required redaction, too, might go into the concept of the, maybe these are instructions to the court as well as to the parties. Do you know what I mean? That the party can ask for this and the court can grant redaction. But you see, two is written that the party does it without any court order, and I'm not sure where two and four fit together.
Well, again,
you don't have to.
Yeah, two okay. relates to what's required to be redacted, those things which are listed in A.
And four is how to do it.
Right. Okay. And four is how to also get other things sealed.
Other things or these protected information also?
Protected information and other things as well.
I think that's what, I mean, I don't know what's bothering Justice Prosser, but I think that's the way he might approach this if he were drafting it. I'm not so sure it has to be approached that way.
I stand correct. I'm going to correct myself because two deals with protected information and four deals with getting documents that are not protected information.
These are not protected.
Right.
In two, the lawyer has to do it himself, herself.
Right. And then four is the motion practice to get something sealed that is not protected information by definition.
So this puts an onus on the parties to
right.
do that.
Right.
So... maybe it needs subheadings, even though, you know, they don't count in interpreting it. But I tried. I don't think I was successful.
Judge, let me just repeat this. I may have missed this. But in there's a in it would be subsection 2 H 3 if the person seeking access cannot locate a party to provide the notice required under this section. I simply didn't see the word notice anywhere prior to that. I do see notice in 4B.
Right.
It seems to me if notice is required under this section, it might be identified a little bit more clearly. That's all I'm saying here.
A subheading or something that indicates that how notice has gotten in these.
What about H2? It says any person may file a motion for access. Written notice of the motion shall be required. That's just above the H3. Then it says if a person seeking access can't locate a party to provide the notice required under H. Then you have an affidavit, but if you can...
I didn't see that word right in front of me.
Okay, but I think that may be the plug in that hole. And the H1 says, access to persons and agencies shall be allowed as provided by law. So I'm assuming that there is either a law, and then this person wants access and makes a motion, or... isn't a law, but this person wants access and makes a motion. Again, there's no timing of how long the court takes.
I think that's, again, something that we would agree you could come up with, or we'd come up with at your request, suggested period of time during which, or by which the order must be granted or denied.
I totally agree with you that that sealing, unsealing, and access are not covered under the statutes.
Right.
And they may be covered by a case hither and yon, but I haven't looked, but I haven't seen a concise statement of, if you want to seal, here's how you do it. Maybe it's in the practice manuals, but I didn't find it.
There is, I'm sure the displeasure of Marcia Vandercook, I'll tell you that I, as a judge, have relied on a memo that she wrote about 10 years ago now and is updated periodically on sealing. We had an issue within CCAP. We searched the records way back when to see what was really going on, what were judges doing, and there wasn't any consistency. They're all over the board, as you might guess. So she came up with a memo that collected the case law, discussed it, and it's what people like me have relied on to figure out what to do when somebody wants something sealed and there is no procedure that's set out in statute.
Is it in the bench book?
No. It's on CourtNet.
How many counties have e-filing now?
How many counties have e-filing? Well, it's by case type. I think there's only one county that's truly completely e-filing. That's, no, not yet.
Which one is that?
Counties have some e-filing in by case type. And the case types are small claims, civil, family. Right.
Is that mandatory or is it
voluntary? The rule you passed in 2008 when I was here last on this topic is the rule that applies to voluntary e-filing.
Well, my real question is, in these 30-some counties, do people know how to file a protected information form through e-filing?
No, because we don't have the rule yet, and we will educate them on how to do that. We'll be educating judges at the conference. We'll be educating clerks at the clerk's conference. We'll be writing articles for the bar, going to them with the information, et cetera.
So that's all going to be ready by January 1st?
Yes. We're ready. So... the last things I'll just comment on are very briefly. This does have support. We've taken this rule to the state bar, to PPAC committees, to the chief judges, the clerks of courts. We've consulted with Department of Justice, the Public Defender's Office, and the Wisconsin Court Reporters Association and the DA's Association as well. So people know about this rule, are aware of it, have all had an opportunity to give us their input. I think the fact that it's we're here today just about alone in support of the bill is a testament to the fact that this is needed and that no one really has any major objection to it, at least at this point. Again, we're prepared to implement this. The suggested date is January 1st of 2016, but if you choose some other date, it's up to you, obviously. But I believe the staff and CCAP are ready to go forward to do what we have to do to educate people so that this can become effective on that date.
I thought you had talked for a few minutes on the
reaction
of transcripts.
Transcripts, yes.
Because as I understand the rule, and now I've lost it in here, once you get to a hearing, you can use information that may be protected at the hearing if you need it.
Yes.
I mean, but
right.
You can do that. So now you have a hearing and you have a transcript and it has revealing the protected information, right?
Yes.
So, and am I right that it could be used at the
yes.
Hearing? Okay. So what do they do now?
They do the same thing they did in the first instance. The party aggrieved gets the transcript, has 30 days to look at it, sees that the information is yet and again in this second transcript. They again file a motion asking that it be redacted. The court reporter redacts it if it's protected information, files that one page. that's redacted in the public record file, whether it's electronic or paper, and puts the original page with the number in it in the file that's confidential.
We have to file here. You do have a time period, 30 days within the time the transcript is filed. A person, maybe a party or maybe somebody else, may file a motion to redact or seal information. What's the difference between redacting and sealing?
Redacting means you're blacking it out, removing it from the record. Sealing means we're putting it in the sealed part of the file. It's still there, but you can't look at it unless you're a party or the court.
Well, I can see sealing a document. I don't know how you seal information. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I see. I get your point. Information is maybe too broad a word.
Yeah. You redact information. You seal a document. Okay, the moving parties are identified by page and line every place in the transcript. Information sealed or redacted. Okay, shall be submitted on or attached. Okay, the unredacted transcript shall be publicly available while the motion and redaction are pending, unless otherwise provided by law or court order. Then it says, the court may order redaction or sealing after the 30-day period for good cause shown. What 30-day period?
30-day period to file the motion to redact. The 30-day period. From the date the transcript is filed, the party has 30 days to file their motion. If for some reason, you know, whatever it might be, sometimes it's a good reason, sometimes it's not, but if they go past the 30 days, this gives the court authority to decide that they want to let the motion be heard and deal
There's
with it.
There's no time period for the court to make a decision.
No, again, that point's, again, not there. No time period for
listening. Well, you could have it, this unredacted stuff open for 6 months.
Possibly, if it's not timely decided or the motion's not brought. You know, in some cases, it may be in the file for years if it's a, you know, three-year-old file and someone decides they want their Social Security number out of that record in their divorce case where they were asked their Social Security number.
Both the redacted and unredacted transcript will come up if it's there's an appeal.
Yes. You'll get the whole record. You'll get the public record and the confidential record. Yes.
Why are... 801.19, why are there comments for subsection 3 and subsection 4, but not subsection 2?
It's the call of the committee in terms of what our thought process is and what might be helpful to you as you look at the statute. Okay? That's the reasoning.
We have a draft order that was prepared by staff, revised and recirculated 4/21/15. And that has comments, but somehow I got the impression, and I didn't have time to go back and check it, I got the impression it had more comments than your document had, but I could be wrong. So I'll have to look at it. Because sometimes, for example, there's a comment to Section 3, and 4, those are the two. And I'm wondering if there are things in your memorandum. Remember, I said I really thought the memorandum was very good. I thought the draft was very good. That might be incorporated as comments to the document.
All right. If you want us to, we can make a stab at writing comments to each of the sections based on our memo and take the memo from the memo back into the statute. If that's helpful, we'd be glad to do that.
One brief one. I cannot remember the rule number, but this term, we had some victims' information issues that came up in the form of a rule, and I think the court passed it, and the rule might even be implemented at this point or close to it. And I saw that in this, it kind of thought victim issues might be a subject for legislative action. But you might want to, if this is going to be looked at further, consider whether that rule in any way impacts what you should do with respect to redaction of victims' names and information so that it's consistent.
And we discussed this in the committee, and for reasons I stated earlier about public policy, there's a statute 950 that deals with victim issues.
But that when the court was, I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but we had a day of testimony and hearings, and a lot of people come forward. Yes, you are, because you're on the council that brought that petition.
Right.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
And the court did pass something, so maybe it should be consistent so that trial courts and appellate courts don't end up in going crossways with each other on the rule.
Yeah. And if you're in your discussion, you want us to draft something that includes something that's parallel to the appellate procedure rule, let us know. We'll do what we can, if that's the consensus.
You don't run into that trouble at the trial court because you're not on the web.
Right.
All these documents are not available.
Right.
Contents are not available.
Correct.
To the public.
Right.
The briefs are available on the web to the public, and that's why the appellate rule was adopted, and it doesn't affect transcripts. In fact, it specifically says it doesn't affect transcripts because they are not on the web, and it doesn't affect, as I remember it, appendices to the briefs because they're not on the web. As best I can remember that, but I mean,
exactly.
It was all web-oriented. This is not web-oriented.
Unlike the federal system, where anyone can go on their system and get any document, the WCCA only allows public access to the file and not confidential parts of the documents. So, different.
At our meeting of the court on November 7th, there was some concern raised by some justices that having a hearing today would be premature. Would you address that
Absolutely.
Concern?
Every day, cases are filed. Whether they're filed in counties, the 32 counties which are doing it e-filing, whether they're doing it by paper, the information is still coming into the court records. We want to start as soon as we can to get this information out of court records and to give people, our filers, an opportunity to exclude what they think should not be in them as well. Why wait? It's not dependent on e-filing. We already have e-filing on a voluntary basis, whether we get to mandatory e-filing or not. This problem is still the problem.
E-filing, they can handle that in that order.
Exactly. And e-filing, it's all done by programming. You know, a judge has a certain security clearance and can get access to the whole file. But if you're John Q. Public and come and you're not a party to the case and you look at it online in the clerk's office at the public access computer, you're only seeing what's on WCCA. The same you'd see as if you were, it's a little bit more than that, but it's what's on WCCA and what's accessible. I hear you thinking, Justice Bradley.
Further the affiant saith not.
Well, she gets another shot at you. The ordinary, and I don't think she's taking shots, or anyone else has. The ordinary procedure is that after we hear from the other people, you are given an opportunity to say anything you want in response, or not necessarily in response. But I do want to thank you for your efforts in this. I had always wondered when I saw the newspaper that said the judge sealed this, that, or the other thing, and I thought to myself, that judge sealed it on this case. Why didn't the judge seal it on a case that seemed to me very similar? And what was guiding the judge? And then And as we've gotten into the John Doe and it's come up here, I've seen the difficulty of what happens when there's a request for sealing. And it just is lying there without limbo until a court acts and there's no obligation to act at any particular time. So I appreciate this, and this is not an easy one to draft, in my opinion. But I thought you did a very, very good job, and I also appreciate that this was vetted through all of these other entities who I am sure added a great deal or subtracted a great deal and gave you insight. So I think the process is very good and the product is too.
Thank you for your consideration. I'll sit down. Thank you.
We've got next Kathleen Madden, Clerk, Waukesha County.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and all of the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court. For those of you who may not remember me, you visited Waukesha County. I'm the Clerk of Circuit Court in Waukesha County. I'd like to respectfully request your support of the petition before you that provides much-needed procedures for the protection of certain personal identifying information that is in our Circuit Court records. This petition provides litigants, court officials, attorneys, and clerks of court with much-needed guidelines and procedures for the submission of confidential information, for the sealing of the sensitive data, and for the redaction of sensitive data upon motion. Court staff currently cannot change the court record, so this personal identifying information is released on a daily basis to requesters. I think that we can all agree that this information should be protected due to the increasing trends of identity theft and other related crimes. There are limited statutes that do provide guidelines or prohibit personal identifying information from being filed with the courts or that address personal information once it is filed with the courts. This petition provides those needed guidelines and the procedures to protect this information. I would like to tell you about a brief story that happened in Waukesha County in 2011. Fox 6 News conducted a secret investigation in several southeastern Wisconsin counties. Their focus was reviewing family files. And their main purpose was to locate personal identifying information, such as Social Security numbers, bank account information, etc. They were successful. In fact, when they contacted me, they had received a copy of a publicly available document in a divorce case for our then current sheriff. The document was laden with personal identifying information for he and his wife. Despite my plea not to run this story, the reporters ran the story. They had been collecting information for weeks out of family court files. They ran the story and they told the public that the court records were full of personal identifying information and anybody could come in to receive copies of it, and there was very little that the clerk could do to protect this information. They exposed this information to the public. They also exposed it to potential criminals and invited them to come to the courts to obtain the very information they needed to commit crimes. This petition does not seal any new documents that are not already sealed by statute. What it does do is it tells attorneys and other filers to be conscientious of what is contained in the documents that they are filing. Attorneys can choose to black out this personal information, or they can choose to seal an entire document if it is necessary. It provides guidelines to do just that. The petition puts the burden onto the filers and the attorneys to protect their clients' information or their own information,
And it gives opposing parties a means to object if their own information is exposed. We're all well aware that our court records are full of Social Security numbers, business records, income tax information, bank account information, mortgage documents, and the like. At a time in our history when identity theft is so common and growing, I think all of us can agree that the court should address this concern. This petition does that. As a clerk of court, I'm pleased that the petition was very thoughtfully crafted to prohibit the sensitive information from entering the court record. It provides a means for getting this information in a more protected fashion under seal. It provides individuals who would like their information redacted from existing records an option to do that. I especially welcome the clear delineation of the responsibilities between the clerk of courts and the filers or the parties. The litigants must identify what they want redacted from the court record. The clerks do not bear the laborious and expensive burden of redacting old records that are already filed with us unless it's requested and approved. I respectfully request your support of this petition to address these serious concerns so that we may all protect our citizens from potential harm. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak with you and for your time and consideration of this important petition. Thank you.
I want to thank you, Ms. Madden, and I do have a question. So I'm going to file a complaint. Might have some information that is personal and might invade privacy, or the other person will invade privacy and affect reputation. So I'm filing it, and I'm filing it under seal. What do you do?
Actually, I think what a filer could do if this rule were enacted would be to file their complaint with a confidential addendum to that complaint with that information that is potentially confidential.
Okay, so I can file the complaint, and I could file a form that says the following information is confidential?
There will be a form provided to allow them to do that.
Okay. So then is the complaint unredacted the way I drafted it, open to public view?
I believe that the filer will be instructed that any of the confidential identifiers not be contained in that base document, but included on that confidential addendum, much like we do right now in the family files, where all of the personal identifying information for the parties and the children are filed on a confidential addendum. So that piece is automatically confidential by statute.
What do you do with this unredacted complaint that has all this information with it?
That would be available to the public. If the rule passed, I believe the confidential information would not be included in the complaint, but as an addendum, a confidential addendum to the complaint.
What about, is the word seal gone for the complaint? I mean, do I have to just strike the confidential information and file the form? Can I ask that it be sealed under, let's see, I'm going to ask that it's going to be sealed under 4, I think it is.
No, I think that any party would have the...
Pardon me?
I think any party would have the right to request it be sealed, and that would be up to the judge. But I look at this question very similar to a current divorce filing right now. So the initial petition is not sealed. It's open to the public. But the confidential information that is really necessary for that case is sealed and not available to the public, only to the parties and the attorneys in the court.
That includes the financial information?
That is correct.
So example, there's under four, submitting a document under seal. This is not necessarily limited to information. Submitting a document under seal, I make a motion. How do you deal with that motion? Is there some sort of tickler that it gets to the judge? You know, I'm getting out after this can sit for a long time.
When motions are filed with the court, they go to the judge for review, and we set it for a hearing. So it will be up to the judge to set it for a hearing. Some judges will authorize their staff to set it for a hearing, or they may want to review the motion prior to setting it for a hearing. But motions, things that do require the court's response, could be what we call, you may refer to it as a tickler, but we will put a calendar call into CCAP so that would remind us that this has to be addressed. And so it will get set for a hearing, and it will be addressed.
But not all counties work the same way on that.
I can only speak for my county.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm not mindful of the current procedure used in the various counties regarding family law matters and the filing of the petition. I'm focusing on the last four numbers of the Social Security number. Currently, the procedure you use in Waukesha County when a family law petition or filing is made, would the last four numbers still be available to the public, or is the entire Social Security number not available to the public in the current procedure?
The current procedure is not just a Waukesha County. There's statute that dictates when the family petition is filed that the confidential information regarding the parties that's very necessary to that case, both the respondent petitioner and their children, that information is contained on what we call a confidential petition addendum. And that is automatically sealed. So none of that personal identifying information is contained in the actual petition, but sealed in that confidential petition addendum. So in the confidential petition addendum, right now, it's the entire Social Security number.
And in the petition available to the public, it's none of it.
It should not be contained in that original petition. And so the public sees the petition, but that information should not be included in there at this point.
Just for clarification, finally for me anyway, the petition before the court here includes information in sub 2, or includes information in sub 2, which is already addressed by statute. And sub 4 addresses those, these are not protected information. Is that correct? So, in other words, sub 4 deals with unprotected information, and sub 2 deals with information that's already protected under statute. I ask that for clarification for me, because I thought at the outset I heard the petition does not seal what is not already sealed by statute.
I know that was clarified earlier.
We tried to set it out in sort of a systematic way. Sub 1 defines. Or is the motion you make not
addressed by law?
Thank you. I have a question about that. Presently, I think the federal government deals with Social Security numbers, although I'm not ever sure that they're consistent as to when you can and can't use Social Security numbers. But does the law presently protect a driver license number? No, I don't think so. And I don't know if it protects the passport number. I'd have to look at the federal. But the 1 through 6, 1 through 5, is protected by this rule, right?
Yes, and maybe a member from the committee that drafted the petition can speak to that, because I believe they took information from states as to what was being protected and then selected what would be protected under this rule.
You gave a very interesting story from, I thought you said, 2011 about an investigation. Under sub 5, could the subject or subjects of those stories file a motion to redact part of the documents in their file?
If this petition passes, anybody that has court files with us or information in court files could file a motion to redact that information from existing files, yes.
So this is not simply cases that are pending at the time, filed before January 1st, 2016. It could be filed in 2010.
That's correct.
2000.
Correct.
Okay. Is the circuit court clerk going to charge a filing fee for all of these motions?
No, the circuit court clerks cannot enact any new fees. They have to be statutorily driven, so there would not be a filing fee to request redaction or charging for the redaction process.
If this were introduced as a bill, I suspect there would be a fiscal estimate for the bill. Is there any fiscal estimate been prepared? And I mean, how many motions under sub 5 do you anticipate?
I wasn't a member of the actual committee that drafted this, so somebody may be able to speak to that fiscal bill, because I think it was reviewed, but I don't have the details. We don't know. We don't know. As a clerk, I don't know how many people will file a motion to redact information. But at this point, as a clerk of court, I think this is very important, and we do need to protect this information. So it may create some work. I don't expect a big rash of filers. I think it'll come in here and there, maybe initially when we start educating the public and the filers that this petition passes or these new rules are in place. Maybe we will have a little influx, but I don't think it's going to be overwhelming for us, and I think it's very important work that we protect this information.
You're authorized under F to the clerk is, or the register, to redact Social Security number and passport number on written request, period. But all other requests for redaction of old information that is previously filed must be determined by a judge or court commissioner. That's under F.
Correct. I think those will be the most frequently requested items to be redacted. Number one, the Social Security number. So the petition was carefully crafted to allow the clerks to make that redaction upon written request. Actually, I'm not, but Carlo is with me, and he is the president of the association, so he'll be speaking on behalf of the entire association.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Is it, as I understand Judge Patak's testimony, many, many counties have scanned older documents, and they're on the computer. How difficult is it going to be to redact those documents on motion or on request.
Anything that has been scanned into the CCAP system itself will be relatively simple to redact. There's optical character recognition software and redaction software that CCAP has available, and that will help us identify and redact that particular information. Information that is not on CCAP may be a little bit more difficult. If it's on microfilm, things like that, we may have to convert it to CCAP. So that's some of the older documents. We've had scanning available through CCAP since maybe 06 or 07, so a lot of our records are now being stored on CCAP. So, but it'll be a learning curve. If it's not on CCAP and on microfilm, we may have to convert it. And again, it would just be on request. It's not going back and doing everything that we retain per Supreme Court rule, but just upon request.
And redacting. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. It's good to be with you again. My name is Carlo Esqueda, Clerk of Circuit Court for Dane County and President of the Wisconsin Clerks of Circuit Court Association. And I'm here representing that association today rather than in my individual capacity as clerk. And I can be very brief because Kathy did the heavy lifting. The Executive Committee and officers of the Wisconsin Clerks of Circuit Court Association unanimously endorse Petition 1404 and urge its passage. We feel it strikes a necessary balance between the protection of sensitive, confidential, personally identifiable information with our interest in administrative ease and efficiency. You know, you've already heard from my colleague about specific benefits that this rule would bring to a given county, so I don't really have anything more to add to that. Of course, if you have any additional questions for me or, frankly, for Kathy still, we are here at your pleasure.
So, what are your answers to all the questions we've asked?
They would be exactly the same. Just with regard to the question about the electronic redaction procedure, that's one that piques my interest as well. CCAP will provide a tool. I've seen these OCR redaction tools in use elsewhere. Very simple. If you have a scanned document, zoom it up on the screen, find the offending string of characters you want to get out, click, highlight, suddenly it's blackened out. You know, it would make the NSA very happy. You have now a redacted document. Save it. You have the two versions, the original plus the redacted version. Original gets classified as the, you know, confidentially protected document, and the redacted one is now available for public consumption. It's pretty slick.
What about the timing for these motions and open and closed hearings?
Really, I see that as a purview of the judiciary. I have to say, I would concur that there's a lot of onus placed on the bench for determining a lot of how this procedure is going to work. In all candor, every time Judge Patak starts out a sentence saying, it is not to be the responsibility of the clerk to, it's music to my ears. We will take the direction from the court, you know, in terms of, creating notices and setting up hearings. But the thing that we're really trying to get away from is this notion that the clerks are the gatekeepers for the filings. You know, we're not supposed to be pouring through documents that are coming in looking for legal insufficiencies, looking for information that perhaps we wouldn't advise somebody to put it there. We're frankly not in the position of advising anyone to include anything in the filing they want to make with the court. So this achieves that. It lets us take at face value the documents that are coming in and leaves it to the judiciary to determine whether the filing is sufficient or whether it contains information that should not be there.
This is on the lawyers.
The initial onus is on the filers, whoever is doing the filing. It will be made known to them what specific data elements should not be included in a filing. If I'm confronted at our front counter with a 32-page pleading and on page 17, three-quarters of the way down, is a Social Security number, I don't want to have to be responsible for finding that. It should be the onus should be on the filer to make sure that such a thing does not occur. And subsequently, if the mistake is made and they want to pursue redaction through the procedure identified in this rule, they are certainly free to do so.
How is that notice going to be provided?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would imagine we're going to have to do a little educating ourselves in terms of signage, perhaps, at our front counters, particularly for the benefit of pro se filers, as I think that the educational effort to the bench and bar will be sufficient through the various outlets for that education.
The Director of State Court's list of commonly filed documents made confidential by statute, court rules, and case law is now not publicly available.
Well, it's available to us. I know it's on CourtNet. I don't know if it's something that's available on the Y Court's website or the State Bar website.
The public get to CourtNet? Pardon me?
So we're generally familiar with those kinds of things, but again, we're not really in the business of poring through and figuring out, do one of these things exist in the document we're taking in? And it would be good to codify that that, in fact, is not our responsibility.
How much utilization of subsection 5, redaction of previously filed documents, would you anticipate?
Yeah, so this goes to your question about how much staff resources, expenses might be tied up in this. You know, it's an unknown. I can tell you right now that I don't have people beating down my door, because the issue of identity theft and so forth is very prevalent. It's been in the media a lot. People are very aware of that issue. And yet, I don't have people beating down my door saying, how can I address this with a filing I made in my family case 5 years ago? Frankly, I haven't found that worth fielding those questions at all, even to say, well, we don't have a procedure, or there's a pending petition that would give us a procedure for dealing with this. Frankly, I don't really expect much traffic on this particular point at all.
Traffic on it now?
Not that I know of, no. If it were, I'm sure my front window clerks would be saying, help, we need a procedure for dealing with this question that comes up all the time and we don't know how to answer it.
If you were going to suggest revisions, what would you suggest?
I think some of the clarifying points that you discussed with His Honor are on point, and I really don't have anything to add other than those kind of legalistic or semantic differences. The broad thrust of the rule in terms of striking that balance between the protection of the information and ease of administration for us is really what compels us to endorse the petition today. Thank you.
Association. For vetting this and commenting. Is there anyone else here who would like to make an appearance on this Rule 14-04? Would you like to comment further? Would you stand in front of the microphone?
Okay. I would comment on the cost issue that came up. We did talk about internally what the cost might be, and as It stands now, all the work to develop the software, like the OCR optical character recognition software, would be done internally and programmed internally, from what CCAP is telling us now. So we're looking at staff time to do this. The other things, there are some forms that need to be developed, but those would be developed through the normal process of court operations on the forms committee. You know, how do you, we come up with a form for like transcript redaction, things like that are mentioned in the memo.
The optical redaction that you described to us before, is that available now in all the counties, or is that something CCAP has to put together to make this go forward?
Not available. It has to be put together by CCAP to go forward, and maybe Ms. Bosquet can answer any more detailed questions might have about how much time, et cetera, it might take and how hard it is to do. We did consider, and I think CCAP did consider, buying software products that are available in the market and has now at this point opted to decide to do it internally. Okay.
If we were to adopt this rule today, where would Wisconsin stand in relation to other states? Would we have be ordinary or
I think from,
groundbreaking or what?
If you look at the memo, I think it's on page 2 near the bottom. It discusses the resources that we researched, and we looked at least 20 states that have existing rules, including federal government. So we're not on the cutting edge. On the other hand, we're not lagging either, but we are, I think, where we need to be and moving forward to do this.
Adam on page 3.
3, sorry.
This is in your memorandum.
Correct,
right?
In the memorandum.
And he especially put notes on page 3 and 4. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, maybe we should hear from Ms. Bousquet about whether this scanner and deleter, your software, optional redaction.
Okay, so the optical character recognition software is software that
I'm having trouble hearing you because our speakers by us are not working. So if you can maybe pull the microphone closer to you and just talk just a little louder.
Okay, can you hear me now? I can get a lot louder.
That would be great. That's okay. Better. Thank you.
So the optical character recognition software is software that allows you to take an electronic document and type a word in to say, I'm looking for the word Bosquet. And when I type that in, it will search the entire document to try to find the word Bosquet. If it's in there, it will show that as a hit, and it will show you each time Bosquet appears in the document. So, for example, if I wanted to redact that on a document, the rule tells the person that's filing for redaction that they have to show us exactly where it is in the document. But OCR would allow you to type in a string, whatever words or numbers, and find matches for that quickly. So you maybe wouldn't have to page down 30 pages into a document. It would jump you right to page 22. Okay? Then when you get there, the next piece of technology we need is electronic redaction. And what electronic redaction allows the clerk to do is to actually use the software to highlight whatever they want to black out, and that will create a second document. And that document no longer shows the Social Security number or the driver's license number. And that becomes the public document. So we still retain the original. The original is available in the circuit courts for anyone who has rights to see the full document. But the public document is now a new document where those that vector is no longer available on the document. That's now been blacked out and hidden.
You know, we can already use find, because when I'm writing, if I'm not sure that I'm using the same word, either plural or singular, I always search for it. So you find it, and you get the hits. So it's like that to start, but then there is another feature that you're going to design that permits you then not to delete it, which we could certainly do.
Right.
But there's like a replace with. So would you replace with a blackout? What I mean, is that how it's functioning?
No, I think you're thinking of Microsoft Word.
Yeah, sure.
And these are all going to be Adobe PDF documents. And so some Adobe PDF documents you can use Find for,
But documents that are scanned in are actually pictures. Mm-hmm. And Adobe cannot recognize words. It thinks it's just like a photograph. It can't interpret where there's actually words.
Okay.
So the OCR takes that picture and translates it into words for Adobe. And then we can take that document and look for strings of information.
So it's much the same, except there's an intervening step in that you have to change a PDF into something you can actually manipulate. So you
Correct.
Put it back in a Word format. And then so you do like a find, and you find all the Social Security numbers, and then where it says replace with, you have a feature that says redact, and so it just puts a blackout through that?
Right.
Is that how
and
it goes?
That's the piece of software we'd have to develop. And so what we would do is we would find those different instances, and then we would let them redact. I don't know how we'll make them do that. It could be a button. It could be that they highlight across it. But we will provide them a feature to do redaction. And all court documents are PDF documents that we store. So some of the functionality that's available in Word we don't have because we bring all our documents in as PDFs so they can't be altered. And so we know these are the authentic official court documents.
But when you're working on it, you transfer it back to Word, work on it, and then you save it as a new PDF? Is that what happens?
Actually, everything is automatically saved as a PDF if it's generated by the CCAP system, so they never work in Word. They work in the case management system. Documents are automatically created and generated as PDFs. And if judges are working on an order in Word through the electronic filing system, that's in Word, and then it automatically converts to PDF when they electronically sign it.
Can I try a little differently to answer the question? The way I heard you answer what I hear Justice Rogensack asking is you don't just transfer it back to Word and do the find and replace function. You need the new programming to, instead of recognizing the PDF as just a picture, it can recognize it as a document that you can go in and redact.
Correct. The circuit courts don't work in Word to do their case management work, and the clerks only work on PDF documents that are part of the system. So they're never in Microsoft Word when they're dealing with documents that need redaction.
The important thing, at least for me, is there's a piece that we don't have yet.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That CCAP has to do. CCAP can change a PDF so that it can be used to find something. Is that right?
Correct.
Because I think we can do that here at the moment, my understanding, in our own offices.
Here's my real question.
But I'm not finished. But what is the time period and the cost for the next step of redacting, which is,
right,
I understand,
think
not
We're working on the optical character recognition. That's been on our long-range strategic plan and on our annual plan to implement that. Clerks of Court are looking for that functionality in the system already. So we've had programming resources that have been assigned to that. The redaction piece we haven't picked up yet. We've already looked into it. It's not terribly difficult for us to do. We did plan on having both of those pieces out and ready for production before January 16. That was our plan.
When these
16, yes.
So that's already on your schedule, and you're working on that. And you think you'll be ready on 2016?
Yes.
Do you have current staff that can do that task?
I have staff that are capable of doing it. We're juggling different priorities. So, again, the redaction thing wouldn't go forward unless the rule passes because we have other priorities that we assign them to also.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
that they're working on right now.
Protected information forms. Do you have a program, or however you would say it, that those will automatically be confidential?
So anything that we know that is in the, if it's on the protected information form, that information is already stored as a confidential document then. So the system knows certain certain documents are confidential, and they're just automatically not available to the public. So if there was a protected information form, that will just be hidden from public view. And we can program the system to do that.
Anything else you think the court should know?
I don't think so. Okay, thank you.
Anyone else who wishes to appear in favor or in opposition to 1404? Hearing and seeing no response, the hearing on 14-04 in the matter of the petition to create the stat 801-19 relating to protected information is closed. The court will reconvene in a few moments and open a conference regarding this petition as well as other items on the agenda. The hearing is closed.